from 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, welcome to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.
Hello and welcome to The Art of the Matter. I'm Travis DiNicola. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Baselli Walrab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
And I'm Sharon Gamble. Today I'll chat with poet Brooklyn Copeland about her recently published work.
I'll get a preview of the Russian Treasures program being performed by the Indianapolis School of Ballet.
And I'll talk with pianist Becky Archibald about rule breaking and her music, and we'll have our arts calendar we call
What'll We Do? All that and more right after the latest news from NPR. Brooklyn Copeland's parents made sure she loved books and reading, so it's no surprise that she grew up to become, among other things, a writer. In 2010, she received a Ruth Lilly Poetry Fellowship from the Poetry Foundation. Her first full-length poetry collection, Siphon Harbor, was recently published, and Sharon Gamble invited her in to talk about writing. She began by reading one of the poems from Siphon Harbor.
11:39 a.m., Grand Haven. Summer seems lessened, buds of cup and saucer scale to frayed extent. Watching us, the gull can limb from the edible, the purely ornamental. The slow yellow sun hones high wisps from low threats, planes of a charged hour bearing down on our wet heads. Parched beach grass holds the dune, 11 lasts all morning. No meaning to assign yet to alewives laid eerily by the tide, two by two. Or your eyes, as you stare, harden to not the blue of the lake nor the blue of the sky, but the blue of a gray rock worn memento smooth. Through bowlful red currant breakfasts, I will recall this minute, steered to its brink, then sank.
You know, before we actually turned on the computer here, you talked about not being particularly fond of reading in public. And that's because I have the sense that you want to have a somewhat more private moment with readers.
Yeah, that's very true. Because I write such, I mean, first of all, I write very short poetry with a lot of space on the page, and it takes me a long time to get to that point. I start with more words, more space taken up by the words, and then I edit away from that. And to get to something so short can take, you know, months or even, you know, a year or two. So I spend so much time on the page, and the whole time I'm in my own mode and in my own writing world. But by the time I get it to what I think is the finished draft, it's something I just want to give complete, you know, and short and precise to the reader, and just have that one-on-one experience with them to say, you know, personally, this is what I have for you to read. So.
And there's a shape to the words on the page that's hard to convey out loud.
There is. It's important for me whenever I'm actually spacing the lines out, you know, and stopping a line. I'm very considerate of where the line, where the words on the line fall. So if you're actually looking at the poem without reading it, oftentimes you'll see words that look very similar or have vowels that are very similar or sounds that are similar. And without even trying to understand the poem, you can sort of get a sense of my, you know, melody or my rhythm, you know, just looking at it.
You love words.
Mm-hmm.
How did that start?
A reader before I was a writer. I was encouraged to read by my mom. We grew up in small towns up in Hamilton County. My family moved between Cicero and Arcadia, and we always were within a bike ride's distance from the public library, which was tiny. But that's what we did. We would ride our bikes to the public library and check out books, and that was our entertainment. No TV. I mean, we had one, but we weren't to watch it very often. So it was play outside or read. And I was surrounded by family members who just encouraged, you know, reading growing up. And then whenever I was able to work in high school, my first job was at the Carmel Clay Public Library, and I was 15, and I worked off and on there for about 10 years, you know, just putting away the books. So I've always had books around me. I've always collected them. I've always read them and been supported in my reading.
I'm guessing there's not an e-reader in the bag you carried into the interview with you.
Heck no.
No offense to those of you who live purely in digital devices, but there's something about, and when I was a little bit older than the job you've just described, I worked in a library reshelving things, and there's something about the smell of book glue and the texture of different kinds of bindings and pages.
Yeah, totally. One of the things I would, you know, sort of, I would always have the sections I wanted to shelve, you know, like the American poetry section or the American fiction section, and I would always look at the oldest books. The first thing I would do before putting it away is, you know, I would open the cover to see when it was published and what edition it was. It was just, I don't know why it was so satisfying to look at that, but just the book artifact itself is very satisfying to me.
One of the things that's been progress in libraries, but is kind of sad in a way, and you're young enough that you may not have had the experience, you used to be able to go in, pull a library book off the shelf, open the back cover, and take out a slip and see who had read it before you. It was an old-fashioned manual checkout system. And I know, in a, you know, the computerized system is much more efficient, but there's that lack of continuity. It was just so cool to see who, even if you didn't know the people, who were these people, and their names had a certain musicality, and you invented lives for them.
Well, they were also, I mean, whenever, I think I'm at the tail end of that, whenever they switched over to the computerized system, the cards themselves were used as what you wrote the call number down on.
Yep.
So they were sitting by the computer, and that was your
good
slip
recycling
of paper. Yeah.
So were you disciplined in your reading? Did you say, okay, I'm going to read the great books from English literature and now the great books from French literature, or was it a more whimsical or mercurial journey?
Whenever I was younger, I read the, I guess you would say, the classic literature for children. I had relatives that would send me books, you know, Charlie and the Chocolate Factory and The Yearling and Anne of Green Gables and all those, you know, ones that you're supposed to read. And I loved all of those, but I also read the junk, too. So. And it's sort of been, that's been the way of it. You know, I'll read trashy romance novels and I'll read, you know, great literature. I have a passion for both. I just love, you know, the printed word. When I was in high school and college, it was more of a peer pressure thing to read, you know, more literary fiction and, you know, abstract poetry and things like that. So.
Yeah, because it was hip and sophisticated,
yes.
Right? Yeah.
Yes, totally. Yeah.
How do you know when you're writing that what you want to write is a poem instead of, say, a short story or an essay or a novel, or a, how do you know? How do you know something needs to be a poem?
Well, I can speak to that because I've written a novel and went through the steps of, you know, attempting to get it published. It went out to big publishing houses, had an agent for it and everything, and it failed. Everybody liked my style. They didn't think the novel had a good ending, or they thought there was something just off about it. So I tried rewriting it, and I failed at that too, and I just put it away. And I haven't written fiction in about 10 years. And it's been only poetry. But I know what fiction writing feels like, and I know what poetry writing feels like. And I think that the way that my habit has become is I think in lines now, versus in concept of plot, versus in fiction, versus in, you know, whenever you're writing fiction, you can see a person, depending on what fiction you're writing, you can see a person and you start automatically evolving a story in your mind, you know, a stranger, you know, or something happens to you and you can imagine it as fiction, you know, and embellish it and get creative with it. I can't do that anymore. You know, I might one day be able to again, but poetry is like so bare, you know, that I think that to write a poem, you start with either the words themselves, very simple, you know, very concise, or you start with some raw emotion or motivation for writing, whether you write political poetry or about something you're feeling, and you run with that. And I think when you're done writing a poem, you check it against that emotion or that concept or that, you know, word that you started with, and is it true to the whole thing, you know, and it stops short of going into something fictitious.
Do you revise much?
Yeah, I revise a lot. If someone were to look at my revisions, they might think that, well, what did she do here? It looks exactly the same. You know, she moved a period. Or
but, wait, there's an extra space.
No, there really is. But if you reveal the spaces on my drafts, you can see where I've made changes. But I do. I start with something and I have to walk away from it, you know, for a few days or a week or so. Like on the weekends is when I actually write, and I don't like writing. It's hard for me to write a first draft, but I love revising.
What do you do if you're driving to teach yoga on Wednesday night and a poem comes to you? Do you have some place you sort of park it in your brain, or do you have to get it on paper, or what do you do?
Well, I can. This happens a lot. I have a notebook I carry around with me, and I can write things down at red lights, which I've done before. And since my poems are so short, it's very helpful because I usually see in like, you know, five or four, you know, a line at a time. So it's fine. But if I'm someplace where it's just not convenient to sit down and beat out a draft, it's more a matter of holding on to what few words or group of words originally inspired it, or writing it down on something that's at hand. You know,
I can see the bumper sticker now. It says, I'm not texting. I'm writing a poem.
Exactly.
Leave me alone.
Or I would rather be writing a poem.
There you go. What's the connection between, or protection between, your personal life and your poetry? Is there any kind of an artificial barrier that you need to put between yourself and your poems? Do you need to get some distance, or can you just put your heart right on that page?
That's an interesting question. When I first started writing poetry, I never wrote about myself.
Really?
Yeah. I was very turned off by what I thought was identity politic poetry or confessional poetry. I didn't want to hear anybody's sob story. Because what brought me into writing poetry was just wanting to get to something sterile and, you know, just strictly word art, you know. So I played around a lot with rhythms, and the poems themselves, I mean, they could be viewed as miniature bits of fiction because they would be about invented women personas. I wrote about personas, but they weren't necessarily mine. And I had a little bit of success with getting some of those poems published, but it wasn't too satisfying. It felt like I was just being clever, which is fine, you know, but it wasn't satisfying. When I started writing about myself, I was very apprehensive about writing what I thought was confessional poetry, which is funny because when I get reviewed now, people tend to be very careful about calling me confessional, but they do compare me to confessional poets. It still comes back to bite me, but I've made peace with that, and I've found that the more factual about myself I am and the more stripped down I am, the more, believe it or not, objective my poem seems. So you can read a poem about my life, and it's all true, and I don't have any problem. I don't think anything's off limits for me. I'll write about anything. And I think that I can do it in such a way now that it is just a poem, you know, like it's about somebody, but it's not me telling a sob story, or it's not me being gushy if it's a love poem, you know. It's a poem about love, and I think I work towards that universal appeal, but at the same time, you can know that it is very personal because I don't need much protection between myself and the page.
How do you know when you have a group of poems that should, number one, be together, and number two, be a volume of poetry?
That's something I do naturally because I do write short poems. It's hard to publish just short poems. A lot of editors, if you send them to journals, they want to see, you know, 3 to 6 pages of your poetry. And if you write very short poetry, I mean, that's like a whole chapbook, you know, depending on how you lay it out. So because I write short poetry, I tend to keep it in groups and I work in series. So I will pick a subject, or a subject will come to me more often, and the group of poems I'm writing about will be around that subject. You know, I know when it's, you know, a volume, whenever I've got that 3 to 6 pages, I can either see that it's complete, or cut out what makes it seem weird, or keep working on it till it's complete and send it to a journal. I've had more success publishing my poems as chapbooks with editors who are more open to the short form, which is helpful because it lets me keep all the poems that I think should be together. When I made enough chapbooks, I thought I was ready for my first full-length volume, and I found a publisher who agreed. So that's how I came to that.
Sharon Gamble with poet Brooklyn Copeland. Brooklyn's first full-length poetry collection, Siphon Harbor, is published by Shearsman. You can learn lots more about Brooklyn at brooklyncopeland.blogspot.com. Again, brooklyncopeland.blogspot.com.
You're listening to The Art of the Matter on WFYI 90.1 FM Public Radio. This May, the Indianapolis School of Ballet presents Russian Treasures, a mix of different dances unified by the music of Russian master composers. Travis DiNicola spoke with Artistic Director Victoria Liris, Kathleen Partlow-Strauss, Director of Communications, and dancer Hannah Rosenfeld about the production.
Vicki, let's start with you. It's always great to have you on the show talking about the Indianapolis School of Ballet, a great local ballet school that also does great performances. But education is such a big part of what you do. Tell me a bit about the school.
Very much so. I opened the school August of 2006, so obviously this is our sixth year, and we have grown by leaps and bounds.
Mm-hmm. And a few jetés.
And a few jetés and on the way. Mm-hmm. But what's different about our school is the background we bring. I am a Balanchine trained dancer, and certainly there was a huge void in this community in the Balanchine tradition. So our school, certainly our pre-professional track, very much follows the Balanchine dictum and the style. So our dancers are trained with that speed and clarity, musicality that is very much needed in the Balanchine style of dancing.
What is it special for you? I mean, there are different styles historically, aesthetically, of ballet, both in terms of performance and choreography and instruction. Mm-hmm. And as you said, you're trained in the Balanchine tradition. What is it that makes that tradition special for you? I mean, you mentioned the speed, but right. But what else do you think of when you think of, you know, a Balanchine piece? I know I'm putting you on the spot here, but what is it that makes it special for you?
Well, for me, it's in my soul. That's where it all begins. Mm-hmm. I started dancing at the age of 8 in his school in New York City. This is the official school of the New York City Ballet, and it's called the School of American Ballet. And not only was our training heavily rooted in the traditional Russian style, where Balanchine was born and trained, but it was infused with also the Danish style, the Bournonville style. We had a little bit of Chaketti in there from Muriel Stewart, a fabulous teacher. But what Balanchine did is he took the rich classical vocabulary of the ballet technique and stretched it beyond I don't want to say angular positions, but to very contemporary levels. Mm-hmm. He is considered the father of American classicism here, because he did take this Russian style of training and Americanized it, yeah, in a sense. He loved America. Mm-hmm. He loved Westerns, and he loved movies, and he just loved America. And he wanted to just bring something out beyond just your standard classical, mm-hmm, technique. He pushed us to the edge, in a sense. So we had to dance with not only precision and speed, but absolute musical clarity and beyond.
Very specific in the style and the movements.
Very specific.
And just beautiful to watch. And I know that your students get a lot out of that, and it's great that that we're joined by one of your students today. Hannah, glad to have you on the show. You've been taking classes with Vicki at the Indianapolis School of Ballet for a number of years now, correct?
That's right. I've been here for 5 years now. So I started in March of 2007 at Indianapolis School of Ballet, I think. Mm-hmm. But I've been training since I was very young, probably 4 or 5 years old. at just local studios in Indianapolis.
And you've been in many productions with the School of Ballet, Capella, Nutcracker, over the years.
Yes, that's right. Mm-hmm. We've done The Nutcracker, Midsummer Night's Dream, Coppelia, and we get to do lots of new choreography, which is very special for us to be a part of that process. And to be part of the process of learning all of these new ballets by such renowned choreographers. This spring, we're even doing a Balanchine ballet.
That's right. That's part of the Russian Treasures piece, which I'm really excited about. It's just a great collection of dances. And we'll talk a little bit more about that in detail in just a moment. But Hannah, tell me about you've had some great success lately with your dance and some awards you've won. Tell me a bit about this, the recent competition you were involved with.
Yes, this February I was involved with the National Society of Arts and Letters competition with the regional competition in Bloomington, Indiana. Mm-hmm. IU, and I was lucky enough to place second for my variation from Sleeping Beauty, and I just want to thank you, Ms. Lyris, for everything you've
pleasure.
Done to get me there.
Hannah's a very hard worker, and she's focused and determined, and that's what it really takes. You have to have many, many elements, not just the desire, but you need to have the work ethic. I just wanted to mention, when we first premiered our Nutcracker here, which is so special to this community and it's indigenous to Indianapolis, Hannah was our first Clara.
Oh, very
so
good.
So I wanted to put that out there.
Tell me about the piece from Sleeping Beauty that you danced in. What made that exciting for you?
Well, this variation, which was the heroine's wedding variation at the end of the ballet, it was actually danced by another girl at the studio the year before for a competition. Mm-hmm. And so I had had the chance to watch her and see all the work that was being done for her for this competition before. And I applied everything that I had learned the year before to this competition. I think that really helped me, along with what I learned this year.
It seems like a lot of the learning that goes on, Vicki, at the school takes place in part because of the older students sharing with the younger students, as well as guest artists that you bring in. That's certainly a big part
Absolutely.
Of it.
Absolutely. And also, we do try to select variations that will really make the individual dancer shine. Mm-hmm. But I think at the same time, it is imperative that every dancer learns all the variations that other dancers are learning, because it just it gives them many more tools to work with, and just really builds their not only their stamina but their artistic approach to interpreting that particular piece of choreography. So really, we are constantly learning and sharing. That's part of the process, and yes, it's important, I think, for the older dancers, the senior dancers, to come back, and some of my graduates who are now at IU and at Duke, and I have a graduate from Oklahoma University who's now in Nashville Ballet. They all periodically come back and dance with us, and I think it's important because the younger dancers see the growth of those dancers, that the maturity and growth that comes with it. And they're phenomenal role models for the younger ones. And certainly when Hannah first started it 5 years ago, some of those dancers were in the school. And now Hannah, the roles reverse a little bit, and now Hannah is in the upper division. So a lot of the younger dancers are looking up to Hannah's. They're a
Very
role
good.
Model, so it's a lovely process of how it evolves.
Kathleen, I might bring you in the conversation a bit here, and we've been talking, of course, about the Indianapolis School of Ballet, and the program that Hannah's in is, I understand, the pre-professional program, but there's certainly other programs that the school offers as well.
That's right.
Briefly talk about those?
Sure. We train dancers from the ages of 4 through adult. We have 3 different programs at Indianapolis School of Ballet. So our young children's program, which is bursting at the seams with adorable children from ages 4 to 7, where they learn the basic vocabulary and positions and get comfortable with movement and It's a wonderful grounding for them to move into the pre-professional program if they if they're showing an aptitude for that. Then our pre-professional program is for dancers 8 through roughly 19, and those are the dancers that are primarily cast in our main stage performances, which happen at the Scottish Rite Cathedral twice each year. We do a Nutcracker every December and then a ballet from the standard repertoire or mixed repertoire programs every May. And then we have this open division, which is for dancers ages 13 through adult. And I think I've seen you in class.
I may have been there a few times.
Yeah.
I need to get back there again. Mm-hmm.
It's a wonderful workout.
It is. It's a great workout.
It's great for folks who danced as children and want to get back in touch with that, or for people who are looking to mix up their training routine. We have a distance runner, a hurdler, who comes in and has actually improved his times through the study of ballet. And as I understand from Vicky, how he articulates his feet and works on his sprint. And it's a remarkable way to apply this study to another athletic
pursuit.
Certainly is.
And a lot of fun. And your studios are also just beautiful. I mean, located right downtown with great windows and a great view of downtown, which makes it nice as well.
Makes it nice for our summer programs where we have kids there during the day. And and it's a full year operation.
Well, let's talk about Russian Treasures, because that's coming up May 19th and 20th at the Scottish Rite. You mentioned that's where you get to perform a great theater that has been your home for the past 6 years or so. And so this program is a mix of different dances. Hannah, you'd mentioned that there's a Balanchine piece in there. There's also a selection from Swan Lake, I know, and I believe there's a piece from Roberta Wong, is that right?
Yes.
This year? So so Roberta, of course, used to dance with Dance Kaleidoscope and great dancer and also photographer, and so that's very cool. So this is going to be a really interesting mix of a program.
It is. It's eclectic and it's very well balanced. It opens, as you mentioned, with George Balanchine's 1967 version of False Fantasy, music of Glinka. We say 1967 because there is an earlier version from 1954. Then followed by Allegro Vivace, which is to Tchaikovsky's String Quartet, and that is choreographed by Roberta Wong, and that is a modern piece. We move on with Act Two of Swan Lake, and then we finish off with Raymonda Act Three.
So lots of great Russian music that unifies a wide variety of choreography here.
Absolutely.
Sounds like a great night. And I know, Kathleen, there's also a special performance and some great sponsors that make this happen.
Yeah, we couldn't do this without our sponsors. And we'd like to make special thank you to our title sponsor, the Crystal DeHaan Family Foundation, who is returning to sponsor us, I believe, for the third season now. It's a phenomenal partnership. And then we also have our associate sponsors, the Arts Council of Indianapolis, the Westin Indianapolis, and our support from our media partner, Wish TV 8. And their support is especially instrumental in our community outreach performance, which we present for free to underserved or challenged members of our community who couldn't possibly afford to come to something like this. And it's the Friday night before we open to the public.
Sort of a dress rehearsal for you all.
Yeah, it's a dress rehearsal, but I think it provides our dancers with real-time feedback from audiences, and it certainly has run without a hitch every single time we've done it. So we've stopped calling it a dress rehearsal, and we call it a preview performance because they really are bringing it every night, the dancers that are on stage. It's remarkable to see these kids really perform at such an incredibly high professional level.
It is.
Their accomplishment is really something to see.
Travis DiNicola with Vicky Liris, Kathleen Partlow-Strauss, and Hannah Rosenfeld from the Indianapolis School of Ballet. Their presentation of Russian Treasures takes place on May 19th and 20th at the Scottish Rite Cathedral in downtown Indianapolis. And you can get more information by going to indieballet.org, that's indieballet.org, or by dialing 317-955-7525. Again, 317-955-7525. Hey, Travis.
Yes, Sharon.
I hear Hallmark calling.
Oh, that's right. It is that time of year.
We honor the people who gave birth to us this weekend.
Exactly. So happy Mother's Day to all the mothers out there.
That's right. Even if your children have four legs.
What?
What? And we have some things that you don't want to take your dogs or cats to on our calendar that we call
What do we do?
Well, you have a household where the children have four legs, and so do I. What do you have for moms?
Okay, so coming up May 17th, time for three, the ISO's Artists in Residence are performing the season's final Stella Artois Happy Hour concert, and this is going to be a ton of fun. It's featuring music by the Beatles, as well as some new original Time for Three work. Of course, Zach Depew, the violin player and ISO concertmaster, joined by Nick Kendall and Rannon Meyer, and they are just terrific guys, and definitely worth checking out this after work concert. Again, this is part of the Happy Hour at the Symphony Stella Artois. You can get more information at ISO. But something else I want to mention is the Time for Three also just came out with a really cool video that's part of an anti-bullying campaign. And if you go on YouTube and search for Time for Three, and it's a new song that they've put together called Stronger. And the video, it's a cover of actually Kanye West's Stronger that they've done. And it's a great video, and dealing with the fact that, in fact, all of them sort of as musicians when they were kids were also bullied. And, you know, now are these great, you know, fun guys who are incredibly successful. And it's sort of based on that. So definitely worth checking out their video as well. Great work that the Time for Three guys have done.
And their mamas are proud.
Very much so.
Hey, if your mama is a motorcycle mama, you might want to, well, you're smiling because you're trying to picture your mom on a motorcycle right now, aren't you? If you have not yet been to see, or maybe you went to see but didn't take your mother, your grandmother, your sister, your cousin, your sweetie to this, time is running short. You have only until August 5th to check out Steel Ponies at the Idle Drug Museum.
Oh,
and
cool.
I know lots of people who officially don't approve of motorcycles who've been to see this exhibit who come out so jazzed, who want, at the very least, an electric bicycle.
Very cool.
But in particular, and here's the hook for taking the lady in your life or your mother, grandmother, you name it, there is a special section, and there was a special effort made to tell the story of women in motorcycle history in America. So check that out over at the Idle Jar.
Very cool. Hey, some other proud mamas out there are the moms of some Indiana Ballet Conservatory students, specifically Sterling Monka, Mark Picar, and Alex Ray, because they all placed in the top 12 for their ensemble, Amelie, at the Youth American Grand Prix International Finals, which was held just about a week and a half ago in New York City. So congratulations to those. They're all members of the Indiana Ballet Conservatory, and in fact, that company is performing Cipollino tonight at or this weekend,
fruits.
Saturday at 7 p.m. at the Toby. It's the ballet about vegetables.
Oh, there have to be so many puns in there, but our time is short today. If you're hearing us on Friday night and your mom is kind of green, kind of believes in saving the environment, take her to the Indianapolis City Market tomorrow between 11 and 4, that's Saturday, May 12th. Why? Because there is EcoFest, an EcoFest indie event dealing with artwork made from recycled parts.
What a great idea.
I know, I love it.
Hey, and at Connor Prairie on Mother's Day, speaking of vegetables, they're having their annual
what?
Mother's Day plant sale for vegetables, herbs, flowers, things like that, taking place. Actually, it takes place all weekend long at Connor Prairie. Take your mom out there to buy some plants.
I like it. You know what? Soo Young-yoon's mother is very proud of her daughter, who's a fabulous up-and-coming violinist, who is performing with the Indianapolis Chamber Orchestra this Saturday night at 8 at the Indiana History Center. She's going to be doing the Prokofiev No. 2 Concerto. The program also features Haydn's Symphony No. 99. So go check that out this Saturday night at the Indiana History Center, 8 o'clock.
Very good. And the last mama I have is Book Mamas, because they've got events all month long in May. But something going on Saturday from 2 till 5 on Saturday afternoon, the author David Smith will be discussing and signing his new book, Indianapolis Television. That's out of Book Mamas in Irvington, but they've got lots of other great events, including Mike Mullen, who you just had on the show last week, Sharon, talking about Ashfall, is going to be out there on Wednesday evening signing his book.
fantastic. Last thing I have, if your mama likes music that is catchy and toe-tapping, check out Dennis Stromat and L'Esprit de... I started to say L'Esprit de Cole. It's L'Esprit Creole, part of the Indie Folk Series concert series this Saturday night at UUI at 7 o'clock. Dennis Stromat learned Cajun Zydeco and Creole fiddling from some old masters who settled up the Mississippi as far as Illinois. So
very cool. So happy Mother's Day to all those mothers out there, whatever you have been a mother of. And we'll be back next
invention,
week. We'll be back next week for more of That Calendar We Call.
What will we do?
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and Central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202. Or you can email us at artofthematter@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on wfyi.org.
Pianist and composer Becky Archibald recently learned that she likes to break the rules. Sharon Gamble invited Becky in to learn more about her life as a rebel at a jazz summer school in a tiny rural French village, and about two concerts coming up in the next few weeks.
So, you in France, huh? How did that get started?
Well, it was through the Creative Renewal Fellowship, the Arts Council, so I just Googled Europe Jazz School. And that's how I found this place, the Dordogne Jazz Summer School. And what sold me was something on the website that said, be careful of the decrepit 800-year-old stairs in the castle.
You took it as a challenge instead of a warning.
That sounds like my place. I don't know why.
800-year-old stairs.
Yeah, in the 800-year-old castle. Yeah.
Wow.
And you do have to be careful there. But.
And so to give us a sense, this is in the southwest countryside of France.
Right.
The town is too grand a word. It's a village.
It's a village called Monteton. Mm-hmm. And I know anyone that speaks French, I'm not saying it as well as they could. But.
So where do you fly into, and then how do you get there? Is there a train? What do you do?
Yeah, I fly to Paris, then take a train down close by to a larger town. Bergerac,
mm-hmm.
And then I get picked up there, and a van takes me 45 minutes to the little village.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. So are you able to leave all your cares behind? Because it sounds like you're going to the moon, kind of. Far away.
Right, yeah. You only focus on music. You don't have to cook or clean or, you know, anything else. It's just you're just constantly learning, and I do some teaching and performing, and all these people from all over the world who are all music kind of nerds,
mm-hmm.
who we all love each other, and we just sit around talking about music all the time, and it's just
amazing.
That with everybody. They get tired of you, but it's
fellow music geeks. I get it.
Yeah, it's just so fun.
So how old is the Dordogne Jazz Summer School?
This will be the 11th year.
Okay, so you've been there a third of its history, more or less.
I guess I have.
Yeah.
This will be my fifth.
And about how many students are there, and how long are you there?
I'm there a week. I've been there for 2 weeks once, but generally I'm there for a week. What was your other question?
How many students? How many?
Oh,
how many fellow
between
geeks?
60 and 80, depends, something like that. And the age range has been 15 has been the youngest. And if Reggie comes back, he'll be 84 by now.
Aww.
So, yeah.
That's fantastic. And you said they're from all over the world.
Yeah.
What language is the primary one?
It's actually English.
Is it?
Most of the teachers are from UK.
Okay.
There's one teacher from France.
Mm-hmm.
The people that run that, you know, that own the chateau, they're all French, of course.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it's English spoken. Yeah.
So how is it structured, or is it structured? Is it possible that at any given time a third of the students might be pianists and you have great big gaps when you want to put a combo together and play?
Or is actually it's very structured. They only let a certain amount of pianists, a certain amount of drummers. Now if you blow a horn, you have more chance to get in because there can be a lot of horn players in one group. But
right.
There can only be one pianist, one drummer, one bass, and a combo. So,
what changed, and I realize this is the whole point of a Creative Renewal Fellowship, but what changed in your life? Because you've been writing and composing for a number of years now. Was there a kind of an aha moment the first year you went to this jazz summer school where you said, oh, wow, I've never thought of it that way?
Yeah, there really was. There really was. So the first time I went was 08, and I wanted to write something while I was there. That was one of my two goals, was one, to just jump in and throw myself into learning to play jazz with people, rather than with Martians, I guess.
I was going to
what
ask,
I do sometimes
you
in my
mean
dream.
As opposed to, you do a lot of solo work.
Solo work, and people have said what I do is jazzy, and I explored a lot of jazz chords in my writing, but didn't really understand how a group works and feeds off each other and stays together. I just didn't really understand it. I'd never been in anything like that before. So so I went to do both of those things, and I managed to write something that first year by going to the practice room at midnight every night after a whole day of work and performing. It was only time to squeeze it in. So the piece I wrote was called Midnight at Montatan. And we were able to perform it the last night, and people really loved it. It's real different because I was in a very rebellious mood.
Really? Okay.
Well, I mean, one of the first things I started learning at the school was what some of the rules are.
Sure.
And
sure.
I'm hearing these same things over and over again. Why should I have to do that? I don't want to do that. So I'm going to write a piece that does...
For example, tell me a rule you broke.
Okay, there's a pattern called 2-5-1. It's a chord progression. And so it's based... I don't know how far to get into it, but if you took the notes of C major, C, D, E, F, G, A, B, C, and you numbered them, C is 1, D is 2, E is 3, and so on. The second note, 2... the D, you'd make a chord out of that, and then you go to the fifth note, C, D, E, F, G, you make a chord out of that, and then back to the C, and that's your progression. And it's used very, very often to punch up the jazz and to turn around a section. And but I didn't really understand it. I just kept hearing about it, and I'm not going to put that in my piece.
You're such a rebel.
So I wrote this piece, and later I found out, it's really hard to improvise on because of this. But on the other hand, the professionals who are there think it's a really special piece because it broke a lot of rules.
Hmm.
So, I have people that think, well, why'd you make it so hard? Other people say, that's really different. That makes me improvise in a new way, and I like it, and thank you.
That's intriguing.
Yeah.
Does it make you want to break more rules?
Well, I guess if looking back, I have three songbooks that I've made after that first piece, I wrote another set. I spent the whole year writing jazz pretty much.
Mm-hmm.
And then the next year I spent the whole year writing another set of jazz pieces. The next year I did the same thing. So now I have three sets of jazz tunes I've written. 33 tunes plus the ones I've written in the past year. Right. But when I look at the first group, I think rebellious because I'm trying a lot of different things.
Mm-hmm.
I'm testing things, things I'm learning rule wise, and why should I do this? Why 16 bars? Why not 17? Why 12 in a blues? Why not 14? Things like that. Why not mixing the meters? 3-4 and then 2-4. Mm-hmm. I have a piece like that. The second year was more of a blues and more blues and blues, a lot of stuff going on in my life,
And then the third year, I would say, is more embracing the rules. Although there's still some pieces that I broke the rules on. But again, those are some of the favorites to people who have been playing jazz for a long time and they're looking for something fresh and new.
Right.
So anyway, so I've kind of gone through that rebellious period and then, okay, yeah, I can see the point of this, but still, you know, I'll do this for now, but I'm still going to twist things up a little bit here and there.
It's a great, I've been to a couple of different camps like this. One of them was a music camp and one was an improv camp. You're not calling it a camp, it's a school, but it's the same idea. You're trapped in this remote place by your choice,
yeah,
with other people who are so inspired by the same things as you, and wherever you meet, you run into each other in the hall and you go to somebody's dorm room and you just start playing, or
we need a pianist, come
together
over here,
yeah,
and
right,
yeah, right.
It's,
and you eat together,
it's like
all the
being
meals.
16, or maybe more likely like being 18 and away at college the first time, and it's so invigorating as someone who's fully adult, at least on the outside, to be able to do that. Yeah. I want to hear the story of a collaboration that has to do with favorite foods. I want to hear about eggs, chips, and
bread. Okay.
I love this story.
Okay, well, so it was the second year that I went, right? Trying to get everything straight. But when I went back to teach composition.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd been there for the first year. And then the second year, I thought there's never that. Well, I guess people were saying, that's what a wonderful once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. And I'm thinking,
No, I'm going back.
I want to go back. So I sent a proposal asking about returning and teaching, and they had never had anything like that before. They hadn't really had a focus on composition. But I said, I'm really inspired. I have a lot of pieces I've written, and I think I can share it with people, and I think I can encourage people who are considering writing. So so I had a group of about 7 people, a lot of big age spread. I had 2 16-year-olds and I had a 60 something year old person too. So I didn't feel like it would make sense to just say, okay, guys, it's Monday, we got to perform Friday, we got to come up with a piece, go, you know, write something, boom, boom, boom. It didn't make sense. I had to figure out a way to help people connect. So I had everyone go around the room and talk about their favorite food. And so what happened was what I hoped would happen. One, they were in a relaxed state. They weren't thinking about music per se, but I took what they said and made it into music and helped them make it into music. So, for example, one of the friends in the group said, well, I really like steak, but it's really got to be good steak. And I said, now listen to the rhythm of what you just said. It's really got to be good. There's a triplet in there. Da-da-da-da-da-da.
Mm-hmm.
Da-da-da-da-da-da. So then we start improvising on that rhythm. And then, so we kept going around the room like that. And so we had a lot of different cool rhythms to work with. And I just wanted to just think about food while you improvise on this rhythm. There's so many funny stories I could go on and on just from that moment. But one of the guys who was from UK, but he was living in France now, he said, I really miss egg, chips and beans for breakfast. And I didn't know what that meant, really.
Mm-hmm.
It sounded really odd. But that became another rhythm that we worked with. So the school's over. I'm back home. It's September. I get this email from one of the guys in the group. And he said, I'm forwarding this to you. I just want you to... he said, Dear Andy, who was the guy who liked the egg, chips and beans, I'm making your favorite breakfast, and I thought of you, and I just wanted you to know that.
Aww.
And so he copied me on it. Plus, he had these photos of him in his little cozy kitchen in England with the pot of the beans and the eggs and the chips, pictures.
Aww.
Of these. And that was just so special. I don't know if that makes sense to anybody listening, but it was so special to me that
it's a very intimate portrait of
someone
else's private moment at home in the kitchen in the morning.
It was. It was. So I just had to write a song about it. So I started thinking, I want to use EGG, the letter, you know, the notes, EG
sure.
and G, somewhere in the piece, and see if I can make that work. And so that's how I started writing it. But, and I don't have perfect pitch, but it'd be like, la, 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 mm-hmm. EGG, which sounds kind of like Little Brown Jug or something.
Sure.
And everything I came up with sounded like Little Brown Jug, and this is not working. So the more I tweaked it and finally came up with something that I thought was really fun to fit the personality of the guy that sent me the note, who was crazy, wild, funny guy. I got all done, and then I thought, oh, no.
No
the
egg.
Egg is gone.
No eggs.
The egg is gone, but the piece is done. I can't change it now. It's just what I want. It's exactly what I want. And it was another, it's a blues, but it had 14 bars. And, you know, I broke the rule there. Plus, I put some chord progressions in that were unexpected. But that's just how it turned out. So then when I wanted to send it to him for his B-flat instrument, I had to transpose it, and that's when I found, oh, look, there is an EGG right there. The egg is still there.
Sharon Gamble with pianist, composer, and rule breaker Becky Archibald. You can hear Becky in concert with members of the Ronan Chamber Ensemble and friends on Wednesday, May 23rd at 7 o'clock at the Indiana Landmark Center, and again with a different set of jazz friends on Wednesday, May 30th at 7 and 9 p.m. at the Jazz Kitchen. Of course, you can learn more and listen to Becky at beckyarchibald.com. Thanks for joining us today. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Bocelli Wallrap Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
Please listen to The Art of the Matter again next Friday at 8 and Saturday at 4 when I'll go on a garden walk.
I'll get to chat with artist Martin Kuntz about his new work and one-man show.
Cool. And I'll talk with Indiana preservationist Jim Glass to learn more about that art form. And we'll have our arts calendar we call
What Do We Do? So please listen next weekend to The Art of the Matter here on WFYI for your information.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you. The Art of the Matter. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. Today's Art of the Matter was produced and edited by Travis DiNicola. The Art of the Matter on 90.1 FM, Indianapolis.